Good afternoon. Welcome on in to Wednesday's Kildare Focus. It is the 1st of February. Spring has sprung. It's also St. Bridget's Day. It's Caoimhe Hearney with you here until 3 o'clock this afternoon. Coming up on today's show, we'll be speaking to Owen Corrie. He's editor of Air and Travel magazine. Airports around Europe could be set for more baggage chaos this coming year. John Lowe, the money doctor, will be telling us 10 things you need to know about pensions in 2023. We'll be joined by Dr. Niamh Witcherly, assistant lecturer in the Department of Early Irish Studies at Maynooth University. She'll be telling us about the history of St. Bridget and her work as a woman. Then lastly, we'll be speaking to Martina Kenny, co-founder of My Lovely Horse Rescue Charity. Their pig shelter is overwhelmed. They can't take any more pigs in. Of course, if you want to get in touch with the show, 045 898 999. You can email studio at kfmradio.com or you can text us.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Hearney. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97.
Now, airports around Europe could be set for more baggage chaos this year. That's according to my next guest, Owen Corrie, who joins me now, editor of Air and Travel magazine and, of course, Ard Clock resident. Good afternoon, Owen.
Most important of all, Caoimhe, of course.
Owen, tell us what's happening, because it's not good news maybe for travellers, is it?
It's been sort of a recovery winter. Let's find the bags that were lost. We're down to about 200 bags of the 20,000 bags that went astray in Dublin Airport last summer. About 200 of really, you know, at this stage there would be discounters. But the big question is this going to happen again? And there's absolutely no guarantee it won't. In fact, I've said it's quite likely to happen. The reason is that most of the bag losses, even the Dublin ones, about 80% of the bag losses in Dublin were bags that were never loaded on the aircraft in the first place. And the two airports that caused most of those problems, four airports caused a lot of the problems, but the two that caused the most are Heathrow and Amsterdam. And in both cases, the airport have said, we're in trouble, we haven't got our staffing level back to pre-pandemic level, and we're going to be in trouble again this summer.
Okay, so basically it just comes down to manpower, Owen, does it?
You know, everything has changed in baggage. You had these amazing this amazing technology. You have got bags being coders, so that, let's say, a passenger misses a connection, they can find the bag of all the bags in the underbelly of an A330 or whatever and get it off without having to wait for ages. It used to happen in the old days. They have all this where they can track your bag. They can tell you it's been loaded in this particular airport, this has been put on this particular truck. All of that technology was going forward in leaps and bounds. When I was going to these big aviation conferences, and quite a good deal of talk was about baggage, and it was all about how the technology has moved on. And we thought we were looking at a situation where bags would never be lost again. Somebody forgot that you need men, and it's always men, it's usually men, big burly men, to actually lift those bags, put them on the aircraft, take them off, put them on a truck. When it came to the summer of 2022, they were in short supply. Trying to recruit them was a big deal. There was a change in security clearances in Dublin Airport earlier in the year, which meant that the people, the companies that subcontracted this, particularly Sky Handling and Service Air and the Aer Lingus baggage handlers, they tried to staff them up, and they couldn't staff them up fast enough. Dublin's problems were replicated in airports all over Europe, but in particular in the two I mentioned, Heathrow, Amsterdam. On the other side of the Atlantic, Toronto was a big deal. JFK was a big deal. We had situations, Caoimhe, where the captain of an aircraft was told, oh, we can get your bags on board for all your passengers, but you'll have to wait 5 hours at the gate. And he just decided to go without. That happened in more than one instance during the summer.
Would the passengers be told that they're flying off without their bags?
That they were.
Oh, okay.
It was a Toronto situation, WestJet. We had strikes as well, by the way. The French ground handlers went on strike a couple of times. There was a couple of strikes in Switzerland. We had bags. We had an aircraft arrive from Zurich for an Aer Lingus with no bags, not one of the bags of the passengers. Now, all of that, in a normal, we lose, like in normal times, you'd lose 50 bags a day in Dublin Airport. Mm. It's the sort of thing that happens. Because the bags don't go into a terminal. They're taken off the aircraft, put in a truck and brought directly to the other aircraft. And while the technology is working and while everybody knows what they're doing, it was, you know, there were still a couple of bags that went astray. That went up to over 300 a day during the summer. We had 11,500 bags that were responsible for the responsibility of Aer Lingus. Usually Aer Lingus are the end of the chain. The difference between Ryanair and Aer Lingus is Ryanair gets you from A to B. Aer Lingus's big concentration has been a connecting, you know, more than one flight sector. People coming through, the likes of Heathrow, the likes of Charles de Gaulle, the likes of Newark and JFK and Chicago. So they were the end of the chain, and about 11,500 bags incidents reported to Aer Lingus last summer. 9,000 of those bags weren't even put on the aircraft in the first place, but Aer Lingus was left with the job of finding them. And usually in the old days, you'd get the bag. Most bags were found within 48 hours and they were put in a little truck and sent off to wherever they were supposed to be. It was chaos during the summer. Where I live in Arklok, the van going to the K Club was appearing every single day with tons of lost bags in them that had finally been relocated, by which time the golfer had gone on to another golf course somewhere down the west or the south. So it was very much find Wally with bags and customers all through the summer.
Okay, so Owen, I suppose, look, most people listening will be wondering, are staffing levels back to what they were pre-pandemic now? And like, should we be okay for this summer?
Staffing levels on security are back. So those security queues, and last weekend in May, listeners will remember what happened there. The Dublin Airport will be able to handle that. Baggage hall, they say they're up to speed, although there has been, it's one of the subcontracted people. And, you know, you've got two big airlines in Dublin. You've got about 30 other airlines and they subcontract the baggage. So they, you know, they say that they're pretty much back up. But my alarm bells are going off because I see the issues in the two culprit airports for most of the havoc of last year. They're nowhere near back staffed where they should be. So the moral of the story is, don't put anything you don't expect to lose in your bag. And while Ryanair will only fly from point A to point B, you get on your aircraft in Dublin and you get off in wherever it's supposed to be going, Salou or Beauvais or Barcelona or Salou. But you've got to, they won't lose the bags because it's pretty much the passenger's responsibility. A lot of people use Ryanair as a sort of a self-connecting hub. Let's say you don't have a direct flight from Dublin. They fly to somewhere like Stansted. They collect the bag and then they check it back in again. Mm. That system is working perfectly. It's all going astray where you're relying on the airline to transfer your bag from one flight to another.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can never erase human error. People have bad days, like, sure, we all have them, and it's only natural that things like that are going to happen. In terms of strikes, Owen, because I know during the week there were strikes in France and Ryanair had asked the EU to step in and stop these strikes. Do you know anything about that, or what's the update?
Yeah, the French are on strike again today. About 20% of the Orly flights, and we only have one service from Dublin to Orly. 20% of the way it works is the French air traffic control go on strike. They tell each airline to cancel a certain number of flights. Usually it's a percentage. It can be 50%, it can be 20% in this case. Charles de Gaulle not affected. That would have been a big deal. And Southwest France not affected. But it's really looking bad for the summer. The French are lining up for a whole series of new strikes. The big issue, burning issue is the pension age there. And the French were like, we've got a lot of publicity about cabin crew strikes. Usually, you know, unions saying, oh, we're going to go and strike and stop Ryanair. In fact, they didn't manage to curtail any of the Ryanair flights last summer. I think the maximum in one day was 12. in the case of Spain, Belgium a little bit more effective. But the one strike that really causes problems is French air traffic control. Usually Marseille is where the action is, where the strikes take place, but they can affect overflights. They can affect flights from Dublin to Spain, and they did last year. And Ryanair's press statement during the week was, why not allow Spanish and Irish air control to take air traffic control to take command of these flights? There's no safety issues involved. It's purely political. It's purely a national issue. You know, each country likes to handle their own air traffic control, which is fine when they're not going on strike. And they're really, really pushing on this, that if the French air traffic control can cause over 1,000 flights to be cancelled at short notice, what's happened to Ryanair in September, something like 12 people involved in the strike, by the way. It was just that the authorities asked Ryanair to cancel all these flights. Causes havoc, costs a lot of money, causes havoc for passengers, and also leads to huge payouts and compensation payouts on behalf of the airline, because they now have to reschedule the aircraft are in the wrong place. It's a big ongoing issue. We have strikes today in England, by the way. The tube is unaffected, luckily enough, although the Bakerloo and Elizabeth lines are both affected. But the Stansted Express, Gatwick Express and the Heathrow Express are all not running. There's going to be more of this, Caoimhe.
Okay, in terms of what Ryanair are asking for then, they want, say, air traffic controllers from Spain or Ireland to actually take over from the French when they strike. Is that it?
Pretty much. Once you're at a certain height, if you're not going to be landing in France, there's no reason for you to be flying below a certain height. At that level, any air traffic control in cross Europe, if we had a centralised air traffic control in Brussels, which they're looking for, there's supposed to be a single... I've been covering aviation for more than 20 years. They've been talking about it for 20 years. A single European sky with an air traffic control system that manages. It doesn't mean just that the individual national unions don't have the power they have to stop international aviation. It also means a lot for emissions. They say, there are different calculations on this, but it could be that we are consuming 30% more fuel than we need to, just because our 27 different air traffic controls aren't joined up and are not don't have the freedom to overfly each other. There's so many handovers and there's so many vested interests involved.
Okay, and where are they in Europe in terms of a European air traffic control? Any progress on it?
Lots of talk and no action. We've got pretty much Eurocontrol. Listeners will know Eamon Brennan from Galway is the commander-in-chief of Eurocontrol. He's been lobbying us for a long, long time. The European Commission have seemingly on side, but the member states are not. It's sort of into the labyrinth of your Brussels politics, but it comes back to one thing, Caoimhe, which is that national governments are reluctant to let control go of something as key as that, and obviously they're beholden to the vested interests within, and in somewhere like France, the air traffic control unions have an inordinate amount of power. There's another problem with them. There are three of them, and they're competing. So, okay, you know, if you're competing for members, if you're competing for headlines, the more militant you are, the better for you, for your profile. And that isn't good for aviation passengers.
Okay, well, Eoin, thank you very much for joining us today. You're
always a great pleasure, Caoimhe.
Thank you. That's Eoin Corrie there, editor of Air and Travel magazine. With that news that airports around Europe could be set for more baggage chaos this year, and of course, flights could be interrupted or disrupted because of strikes that are planned. There's strikes going on right now in France, and there will be to come in the next few months as well. And Eoin saying there that they're looking at maybe letting air traffic controllers from Spain or maybe Ireland or other European countries step in and take over from the French if that does happen. But we'll have to wait and see. Hopefully, no one in Kildare or any of our KFM listeners will be affected. Now, you probably have already heard today that almost 10 million euro in active travel funding has been allocated to County Kildare for 30 different projects around the country. And Owen Beattie has all of the details.
Yes, thanks, Caoimhe. If we start off in the north of the county and the Maynooth North-South Corridor, 90,000 euro received there. The Royal Canal Greenway in Maynooth, 3 million euro, 10,000 euro to the Naas Kill Active Travel Scheme. The Green Lane Active Travel Scheme getting €240,000, €5,000 to the Naas to Salins Greenway, Salins Village Active Travel Scheme €140,000, Selbridge Road Active Travel Scheme €10,000, the Kilcock Road Active Travel Scheme €20,000, Craddockstown Active Travel Scheme €160,000, €2.675 million for the Kilcullen Road Active Travel Scheme, Selbridge Active Travel Bridge €500,000, active travel office staff costs €700,000, the Athy active travel scheme on the R417 €60,000, €90,000 to the Monreed Road active travel scheme and €150,000 to the Dublin Road scheme. Cycle parking in the county receives €110,000, €10,000 to the Leakslip to Maynooth interim cycle scheme, Monastrevin Town active travel scheme €15,000, Naas to Newbridge Urban Active Travel Scheme €100,000, the same amount to the Newbridge Road Scheme and the Newbridge Active Travel Scheme for the R445 and the R416. Cycle safety improvements at existing signalised junctions €800,000, €500,000 to the Blessington Road Active Travel Scheme. The Meadowbrook Active Travel Scheme gets €110,000, €10,000 to the Maynooth Active Travel Scheme. And then if we look at the Safe Routes to School Schemes, Round 1, Strafford National School, €50,000. The same amount to St Bridget's Primary School in Kildare Town and Holy Child National School in Ballycane. And then Round 2 of the Safe Routes to School, Patrician Primary, St Conlett's Newbridge, €20,000. Scullvreda and Scullforic in Clane, €20,000, and also the same amount to Skullmacua in Selbridge. And finally, in Popular Square in Naas, active travel measures there, €50,000, bringing the total to 9.96 million, just shy of 10 million euro.
Thanks for that, Owen. And of course, a total of 30 projects receiving the funding there. But the big news, that Kilcullen Road Active Travel Scheme to receive €2.7 million. So well done to Kilcullen and of course to everyone who is getting that money. Now, coming up after the break, we'll be speaking to John Lowe, the Money Doctor. He'll be telling us 10 things you need to know about pensions for this year. So don't go away. Now, what will 2023 bring? Well, apparently, it's been promised for years, an employee pension auto-enrolment scheme will be introduced, or should be introduced, by the end of the year. And I'm joined now on the line by John Lowe, the Money Doctor, and he's going to tell us 10 things you need to know about pensions for 2023. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Caoimhe.
John.
And actually, it's ironic, by the way, your previous singer, he was 42 years old yesterday.
Was he?
I might mention that by way of passing.
Big fan of Justin Timberlake, are you?
Well, actually, I know him.
What?
Ironically, that's a long story, but...
You'll have to tell us, John. Go on there.
Well, his chief executive for 22 years was my very good friend. And so I knew her before she got that job. Sadly, she died 6 years ago this next month at the age of 54 after 23 years managing him.
God, that's awful. That's terrible. And have you met Justin Timberlake?
Oh, I played golf with him.
And what's he like? Tell us.
Very nice fellow. He plays off three. Gave me a few tips. I organised a round of golf in Scotland and Ireland here. And he liked the K-Club so much that he cancelled the Portmarnock kind of tea time that he was given for his mum, his dad, his stepfather, and myself and himself. And so he played the K-Club twice.
Wow, so he'd rather stay in Kildare than Dublin. Fair play to him.
Yes, exactly. In fact, it was right in the middle of a Saturday as well, and they very kindly allowed him in the middle of the members' kind of competition to have this four-ball go out.
Well, in fairness, if you have Justin Timberlake, I think you have to kind of let him do what he wants, don't you, John?
Yeah, you do.
Have you ever met his wife, Jessica Biel?
I have. Kissed her on the cheek as well.
Oh my God, John. We're getting more than we bargained for today. She's as good looking in real life as she is on TV.
Absolutely fabulous. They're two kids now. But, you know, he doesn't need to worry about pensions.
No, he certainly doesn't.
He's worth about $270 million, so, you know. He's not doing too badly.
He's not. You didn't have to give him any advice.
No, he was giving me the advice.
Yeah. Well, listen, John, unfortunately, I am not a world famous singer / actor, so I do need some pension advice. John, tell us about this auto-enrollment scheme and how it's going to work.
Well, the first bad news, actually, is that it's not going to happen till next year. It's been deferred yet again. This should have been brought in, you know, 25 years ago. We are sitting, Kiva, on a time bomb. At the moment, we have about 700,000 people over the age of 66. All of them are kind of drawing down €265 since the 1st of January, 30 cents. And if you're kind of on your own, you get an extra €22, I think, as well. So the 700,000, in 30 years' time, even way before you're going to be retiring, there's going to be 1.8 million of people. We're living longer, healthier, fitter. I mean, when I joined the bank initially years ago, the normal routine was the bank manager retired at 65, and 6 months later he was dead, and everybody was happy. Because that was the norm. Now they're retiring earlier, they're living longer. The average median age now is about 85 years. So last year, for every person who retired, there were 5 workers. In 30 years' time, there'll be 2.
Okay.
So it doesn't take a rocket science to work out that this government simply won't have enough money going into the coffers to be able to pay for the 1.8 million people who will be retired at that point.
Okay.
So that's why something has to give, and that's why the auto enrollment, which should have been put in years ago, where they force employers to set up a pension for their staff, for their employees, and that the employees will contribute to it. But it's really pathetic, even the system that they're going to be bringing in next year, because it starts off at like 1.5% each. So the employer pays 1.5%, employee pays 1.5%, and 10 years later, that same employee now pays 6%, and the employer pays 6%, so it's 12% going in.
Mm-hmm.
So the government will add another 2% to that, so they'll be getting 14%. If that employer is under 30, that employee can actually put in 15% straight away right now and make it tax efficient for every 100 euros that you put into your pension. Even if you're on the 20% tax rate, you're getting 20 euros back from the government. It's a no-brainer. Like it's you're up 20% before you start. If you're under 40%, it's even better.
Okay. So if you're saying, so like, right, John, you're probably, this is not what you'd like to hear now, right? But I'm going to be 30 next week.
Oh,
and
my
I don't have a pension. Okay.
Yeah.
And like, this is like a lot of my friends work public sector jobs. So like, that's all sorted out for them. And I lived abroad for a while. I haven't worked in the same types of jobs all the time, but there is this feeling, and I've heard it within my own family from friends of my families, you know, where people have paid into pensions for years and years and years and years and years.
Yeah,
they come along then, and they're getting basically nothing back, or things go wrong and they lose the money, and like I've nearly been brought up in a way to think pensions are bad.
Okay, that's quite understandable, because one of the problems here is information and misinformation and not being told. I mean, people, when you start talking pensions, people's eyes start to glaze over. And, you know, it's so important. I had a 26-year-old girl in my office less than a year ago. And after I gave her a little chat, and she set up a peer essay with me, and she was visibly upset, not over the fact of the future, but of the past. She had missed out already on 2 years' pension contributions.
Okay.
So that's unusual, I have to say. That is unusual. But like in your case, at 30 years of age, it's still not too late. The younger you start, I have to say, the better it is. But whatever you're on, from next week when you're 30, you will be able to put 20% of your net relevant earnings. So if you're earning, you know, say 30,000 a year, then you could put, you know, 20% of that, that's 6,000, into a pension. And of that 6,000, you will get, 1,200 back from the government tax-free.
Okay.
That's you know, your tax relief on it. So if you're on a higher rate of tax, obviously at 30,000, if you're on 30,000, you're not on a high rate. Mm-hmm. You now would have to be on something like over maybe 44,000, 45,000 to be on the higher rate of tax, especially since the last budget.
Okay.
So anybody who's on over 45,000, it is well worth their while thinking pension.
Okay.
Because you're going to get it back. Now, there's one thing about getting tax relief. The second thing is you can dig a hole and get that money and shove it in. Just like you said, when it comes down to retirement age, there's nothing there. That's because they haven't monitored, they haven't been given proper advice as to where that money should be going. So in other words, they have all these managed funds, which are the best probably vehicle for pensions. But some are better than others, some outperform others. And it's knowing then what kind of how to get into it. And what, if I give you an idea of, say, five funds, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, the lower the number, the lower the risk. So number two, you've got cash. But the corollary of cash right now is, number one, you're losing on inflation, but number two, there's no interest. I mean, they still haven't reflected the interest rate rises on the borrowing, you know, on deposit accounts. So, for instance, the very best regular saver account at the moment is 0.75, and that was only upped last week by Bank of Ireland by 0.5% from 0.25%.
Okay.
So it's really, really pathetic, because over in England, where they have sterling accounts, you can get 7% on a regular saving account.
Okay.
So here then, you know, you're putting kind of, you should be kind of putting money away. So number two, as I say, is cash. Number three might be government bonds. Go up the other end, number six. Now you're talking about, you know, emerging markets. Number five might be technology stocks, energy stocks. This is where all the growth is. So you are a young girl, basically, and you want to grow. There's no chance of growing if you're, say, a number two or number three fund, but you have every chance of growing 4, 5, and 6.
Okay, but so if are 4, 5, and 6 then high risk? Because, like you're saying,
they're
about misinformation.
High, yeah, but over, I can tell you the last 30 years, from 1991 to 2020, the average, if you started paying money into your pension then, the average annual growth each year was 10.72%. Now, during that period, you had recession of 2006-07. You had, 2-3 years ago, you had the coronavirus. The stock market went down 20-30%. If you didn't panic, 4 months later, it all came back, and you were back to normal, back to the same with the Ukraine war. The Ukraine war has depleted the stock market, and it's gone down again. But that's not going to last forever. So cyclically, the stock market is the best asset class of them all. It's better than property, better than gold. Warren Buffett is 93 this coming May. He lives in his own house that he bought in 1958 that cost him $31,500. That now property, which was a detached big house, is now, he pays more in taxes than he did to buy the house in the first place. He is the third world's richest man, worth $100 billion. But he said a great line: the stock market is a mechanism for transferring wealth from the impatient to the patient.
Okay, so you're saying you just have to be patient, and you will.
You have to be patient. You've got youth on your side, which is the great thing. So you don't have to worry about, you know, you monitor it, though, and you get a professional advisor to make sure that it's going in the right direction. So you should sit down with that financial advisor every year to check that it's on the right path.
Okay,
and
so
then you're fine.
Quickly, before I let you go, John, because I'm way over time, these horror stories that you hear of people losing a ton of money, what has gone wrong for them?
That's down to really timing. They could have, for instance, decided to, you know, get their pension in the middle of that coronavirus 3 years ago when it went down 20-30%.
Okay.
So timing is absolutely everything. Let me give you one quick example then of a lady who came to me. She had an AVC, an additional voluntary contribution. She had a big pension and she wanted to now cash it. She was 65 years of age. She put it in to an ARF, an approved retirement fund. There's lots of rules and regulations with that. However, having taken the the tax-free element out of it. She had to take, because she was 65, 4% a year, and then when she hit 70, 5%. This was 8 years ago. So she also had to pay about 1.5% annual management charges each year for this fund. So the 212,000 that she invested originally 8 years ago, when she came to see me last year, I said to her, what do you think is left in the fund? And she said, maybe 130,000? No, you have taken out 94,000 so far out of that fund, and you've now got 226,000 left in the fund.
Wow, okay.
14,000 more than she had invested originally. So that's the whole point of the stock market. You know, you monitor, you can make sure that it is kind of, you preserve and grow. They're the two words that are very important when it comes to pension kind of investment or any kind of investment. Preserve and grow. Preserve what you have and make sure that it's growing.
Okay, well, that is John Lowe, the money doctor, there with 10 things you need to know about pensions in 2023. Preserve and grow. And John saying there, if you don't have a pension, you need to get on it. And thank you very much to John for all that personal advice. Thank you.
Kildare Focus with Caoimhe Harney.
Now, my next guest says, despite making St. Bridget's Day crosses at school, taking her name for her confirmation, doing a master's thesis on her and writing about relics in her PhD and lecturing many students about her, she said that she never truly reflected on who St. Bridget was. And I'm joined now on the line by Dr. Niamh Witcherly. She's assistant lecturer in the Department of Early Irish Studies at Maynooth University. And she's here to tell us about St. Bridget and the history of her and her work. Good afternoon, Niamh.
Hi, Caoimhe. Thanks a million for having me on.
Of course, Niamh. Tell us a little bit about, I suppose, you're clearly very schooled in St. Bridget herself, and tell us a little bit more about it.
Yeah, and I phrased it that way, you know, that you just kind of repeated there, because I suppose I've been studying her for so long, and she's been such a part, I think, kind of everybody in Ireland's life. And anybody, I think a lot of women now are telling me, you know, that they took her name for their confirmation and all that kind of thing. And you learn about her in school and everything. But I was kind of studying what other people wrote about her, you know, and all the different, you know, her as a saint and the cult of the saint and everything. And not only kind of in the last year with the new public holiday coming up that I really kind of delved into, okay, but what really about the real woman, the real Bridget? And, you know, instead of focusing on the stories about the saints or the stories about the goddess, but what about the actual Kildare woman, you know, and what she achieved?
And what did you find, Niamh, in your conquests?
Yeah, and I think really what I found was that we scholars, we tend to kind of say that she's an elusive figure and that there's not a lot of hard historical information about her. But actually, we don't have a lot of hard historical information about all the kind of the male saints and, you know, the founding male kind of founding fathers of the Irish Church either. And it's kind of only Bridget. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, the patriarchy at play there, that it's kind of only Bridget who's kind of dismissed a bit more. Whereas actually all of the earliest sources that do speak about Bridget, they all concur that she was kind of this this dynasty called the Fochart, which were based, had different kind of branches of the family around Leinster. They were a real Leinster dynastic group, and they had different branches, as I said, kind of around what the Diocese of Kildare and in Offaly and that kind of area of kind of northwest Leinster. So they all concur that she was from this family, the Fochart. And also all of the sources concur that a woman founded the Church of Kildare, which became the most kind of powerful institution in this part of the country. It was second only to the Church of Armagh. It was a very influential institution in medieval Ireland. And they all concur that a woman founded that institution. And as far as I'm concerned, that woman may as well have been called Bridget, because, you know, the sources say that it was a woman called Bridget. And I think we're kind of told, well, you know, maybe they said she was called Bridget because, you know, there was a so-called pre-Christian goddess called Bridget and that kind of thing. But, you know, to be honest, I don't think there's any good reason for questioning that the woman who founded Kildare was called Bridget, because it may have been a popular name. There's no reason to say that she wasn't. In our generation, we have so many women leaders called Mary, for example.
Yes,
you know,
of course, yeah.
You could get mixed up between the different Marys. Yeah, kind of when people say, You know, what do we really know about her? Well, we know that a woman, you know, who's called Bridget, founded this powerful institution at Kildare, and that she was of the Fart, that she was a Leinster woman.
Do we know much about her family or her earlier years of life?
Oh, you know, the stories that are told about her, they date, so as I said, for all of these early saints and these kind of founding members of the church, all of the stories really survive from the 600s onwards. So we're talking, you know, at least 100 years after these people lived. So we have to take all of the stories with a pinch of salt. But what we do know about women like Bridget is that they... she would have been well connected. She probably would have been, you know, aristocratic in the sense that she would have had maybe a brother or a father or an uncle who was able to grant her the land to found her church, okay? Because Ireland at the time was very hierarchical and patriarchal. So it was hard to get anything done unless you kind of knew the right people, and we're familiar with that story. But she probably, as I said, was well connected, that she was given this, you know, kind of grant of land in the first place, because it was kind of hard to achieve anything otherwise. The stories, the earliest stories about her say, and some of them kind of differ, but they all agree that she, that her father was a noble man. And then one of the stories says that her mother was also a noble woman, but other stories say that her mother was a slave of this noble man. And again, I think what that tells us is that that kind of thing, we know from other sources, was very common in medieval Ireland, that, you know, men, high status men, might have had children from many different women, you know, that they had their wife, but that they also might have had, you know, they might have had relations with, you know, their the slaves in their household, because, you know, it was, as I said, a very kind of highly stratified society, and, you know, slaves were very common, as were kings and kind of different various grades of nobility.
And different things about St. Bridget have popped up over in Switzerland as well here that I see was written. Do you know anything about that, Niamh?
Yeah, so I think what we can see is quite quickly the veneration and the fame of Bridget spread far beyond Kildare, far beyond Ireland, and to kind of parts of Western Europe, as we now would call it. So one of the examples is we have these tags, right, that have turned up in the Abbey of Saint-Maurice d'Agon, which is in now Switzerland. And they were little tags, you know, tags as you now, labels that you would attach to something. You know, you'd have a label attached to something telling you what it is. And these tags would originally have been attached to relics. So relics of St. Bridget, St. Conlade, who was Bridget's first bishop in Kildare, and Dar Lugdach, who was Bridget's first successor in Kildare, so kind of like one of the first abbesses in Kildare after Bridget. So this is really important because the tag dates to probably the year 700. So it shows us that as that's a really early date to prove that the, you know, the fame of Bridget had gone as far as Switzerland by that date. And we don't see this happening with other Irish saints. So Bridget is really important, and that her fame and the stories of her kind of holiness and her strength and her virtue had already kind of spread around Europe.
Yeah, I mean, like the year 700, it's so long ago, you know.
Yeah.
And like St. Bridget herself, like if we look at the modern day and feminism and all that, like she was a trailblazer, wasn't she?
She really was, because again, I think it's really important to stress that medieval Ireland was very different to now in this idea, as I said, that it was very patriarchal and hierarchical. So it was hard if you weren't born into high status, and if you weren't a man, it was hard to achieve anything. Women had very limited legal rights and very little free agency. So Bridget found a voice within the church, because the church was one of the only avenues in which women could actually, you know, receive an education and to achieve anything. And she founded, again, any founder of a really powerful institution was a big deal, right? So Kildare becomes, as I said, you know, one of the most powerful institutions in the country. And it's really remarkable that a woman managed that. So a woman, this is such a big part of her lasting legacy, because all of the subsequent women of Kildare and the subsequent leaders and abbesses of Kildare, they, at any given time in Irish, in medieval Ireland, they were the most powerful woman in the country. So they were more powerful than queens, right? Because queens were still beholden to, you know, their husbands, their sons, perhaps, and their different male relatives. Mm. Whereas we see that the woman leader of Kildare, you know, that she had a certain amount of power and authority in the country. And that was a really big deal. So that, you know, the woman of Kildare really was a really influential woman in Ireland. And I think that that's a massive legacy. And we see all the women, you know, abbesses of Kildare and everything, they're recorded in the Irish Chronicles. And unfortunately, very few women are recorded in Irish medieval history. So it's a big deal that what we're really being shown is that the woman who was heading Kildare was a really authoritative woman, and she was respected, and she's called the heir of Bridget.
And would she have been respected by her male counterparts, or on par with her male counterparts, Niamh?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Caoimhe. I think the, you know, the question is whether she was still had to be deferential to her bishop, you know, because the church is very hierarchical and patriarchal as well, as we well know. So there's kind of, we're getting little glimpses in the sources that maybe in some cases she was viewed as equal to the bishop, you know, and that she was holding her own. But I think we also need to bear in mind that, you know, there is that hierarchy in the church. So you have, you know, the bishops, the archbishops, and ultimately the Vatican. But in the 12th century, there was question mark over, there's kind of a couple of men made comments that the abbess of Kildare was claiming as much power as a bishop. And they said, that's not on.
Okay.
You know,
okay, they
so
weren't happy about it.
Yeah, they weren't happy about that. So we're getting glimpses there that maybe the woman, the, you know, the abbess of Kildare, that she was respected as much as a bishop, but that, you know, that wasn't acceptable. So we can kind of see, and as I said, because we have so many mentions of women of Kildare in the annals, that, yeah, I think, you know, she probably was holding, you know, her own in relation to the other kind of male leaders of the church.
Okay, so interesting. And that is Dr. Niamh Witcherly, their assistant lecturer in the Department of Early Irish Studies at Maynooth University, telling us all about the history of St. Bridget and her work, of course, a trailblazer of a Kildare woman back in the early 500s. If that's what you want to call it. There are a few things happening around Kildare today, this evening, and this afternoon, 2:30. It's already started, I suppose, over there in the Sullis Frieda Centre. There's also at 3:30, the story of St. Bridget at Maynooth Community Library. At 5:30, the History Light Show at the Potato Market in Naas. And then at, 5:30 is in the Potato Market in Naas. At 6 o'clock, Nothing Compares. It's a concert, a celebration of Irish female artists. Imelda May will be there, and Hot Press Magazine, that's happening in the Moat Theatre. At 6 o'clock, there'll also be the lighting up of Kildare, the Hill of Allen, and at Cupid's Town Hill. And then there will be a service of different Christian beliefs at St. Bridget's Church in Kildare, and that's at 7 o'clock. So if you want to head over to any of those things, of course, do get involved. And I think I'm probably we'll head into the Potato Market in Naas later on to see what is going on. So that's all we have time for today. I want to say a quick happy birthday to Conor McCarthy. That comes in from his besties out in Eadstown, Owen, Adam and Jack. So happy, happy birthday to Conor McCarthy, and we hope you have a great St. Bridget's Day. That's all we have time for.